on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on the Navajo Code Talkers. You know, we've had veterans on the program in the past who worked with the Code Talkers in the Marine Corps in the Pacific, but we've never had a chance to listen to an actual Code Talker himself. Thanks to Bill Toledo of Laguna, New Mexico, we're getting that firsthand account today. One of the links I have for you at hometownheroesradio.com is to a book called Warriors, Navajo Code Talkers. It features photos of individual Code Talkers with short accounts of their contributions during the war. You'll find Bill Toledo on one page, and on the opposite page, his cousin, Preston Toledo, who he'll tell us a funny story about in a moment. Bill told us how a Navajo Marine came to the boarding school where he was, looking sharp in those dress blues. Bill wanted to be just like that Marine named Johnny. So he and a few friends decided to enlist, and that prompted, of course, another move.
So he sent us to another school, Fort Wingate Boarding School, about 12 miles east of Gallup, New Mexico. So he took our health. We all passed except one of the guys and didn't pass. His name was Preston Toledo, who was my cousin. He said, come on, guys. He said, think of something. He said, I don't want to go back to school. He said, I want to go with you guys. Think of something. But the recruiter said, after lunch, I want to wait you guys again, he said. So Preston, we started teasing him. We told him that he should put some rocks in his pocket or some sand, you know, so he can pass his weight. And I said, don't tease me. He said, I want to go with you guys. And we ate lunch, and coming back, I had an uncle too. His name is Frank. Frank told Preston, he said, Frank, Preston, you go run back to the dining room and drink a lot of water. Says you drink as much as you can stand it, because we were told that he's going to wait us again, you know. So he went and drank a lot of water. When he got weight again, he passed. Oh, he was happy, you know, and he served with the 6th Marine Division, Preston did. And I served with 3rd Marine Division, and Frank served with 5th Marine Division. We all went in together. Went through boot camp together, and we went through code school together. And then after we graduated from code school, they had to test us. Marines didn't want us to write the code, 211 code, to put it on a piece of paper and carry it around on the battlefield, you know. They didn't want that way. They don't want it that way. So he told us that we were going to have to memorize it, the code, you know.
Because if it was written, then it would be susceptible to someone figuring it out, right?
Because when you get killed on the battlefield, the enemy will search you for information, you know. So then the Marines didn't want it that way, so we had to memorize it. So I passed the test, and I was assigned to 3rd Marine Division. So we all memorized it, you know, and it went real good on the battlefield. The way it worked was the commander of the unit on the battlefield will write a message in English, whatever the troop needs, you know. We sent the message, this English message, we used the code over the radio to another code talker. When he hears that code over the radio, he will transmit that back into English. The faster you receive it, the faster you send it, you save life. You know, so we saved a lot of lives of the Marines, and that's how it worked on the battlefield.
Do you remember, maybe not a specific message, but can you give us an example of the kind of information that you guys would transmit that way through the code? Mm-hmm. Was it troop movements or Japanese positions, or what kind of information?
Whatever the commander finds from the frontline troops, he will write it down on a notebook. Like we were trying to take a hill. Because there was a machine gun in the hill. Every time you approach the hill, it opened up on you with the machine gun. This commander will write a message, request artillery fire on hill 632 over. And then I had to send There'll be a code talker where the altar is located on the beach about a mile away. And I'll call him that I'm sending and send him a message. Request Joe Kidd Bill Dotsosana Sinta Tsa Tasta na ki Asta ta na ki Bahastis. Request altar fire on Hill 632 over. And then I tell him that I translate this message. Code name for Hill is Horse. Horse is sick. Code name for horse is sick. Hill. I said, Shin da tsa. Asta ta na ki. Bahatis. That's a code name for a heel, is sick horse. That's how we translate them, you know. Sometimes they're longer, you know, it's a different code. And the faster you send it, the faster you receive it. You save life.
And you know now that it was unbreakable. But at the time, were you ever afraid that someone would crack the code?
At that time, we were told that the Japanese was number one code breaker in the world. That's why we use this code, you know. There's a story about it in here where this Anglo man, he was a young boy, son of a Presbyterian missionary. They moved from the Midwest to Flagstaff, Arizona. They set up the church there on the west end of the Navajo Reservation. So every Sunday, these Navajos in that area, they come.
They would come to the church service, and before long, the young boy was translating Navajo for his parents, the missionaries. At this point in our interview, Bill kept elaborating on this story about the origins of the Code Talkers, but he also had an entire bus full of European tourists debark right in front of his tent. They were very interested in what he was up to there, so I stopped recording so he could sign some books for them. I can, however, pass on the rest of that story before we get back to Bill's words. The young missionary kid in question was named Philip Johnston. He was speaking Navajo by the age of 5, and that's when he started translating for his parents. What I'm sharing with you here comes from Bill Toledo's account, as well as the official file on origins of the Navajo Code Talkers on the National Security Agency's website. Chuckle all you want there at the NSA reference, but it does paint a very vivid picture of what took place before Bill Toledo and so many other Code Talkers got involved. And without Philip Johnston's persistence, it never would have happened. I'm going to read to you now from that NSA account because I think it adds a whole lot of perspective to our first-person account from Bill Toledo. Here's what it says about Philip Johnston. By age 9, when most boys his age were riding bikes and trading baseball cards, he had served as an interpreter for a Navajo delegation sent to Washington, D.C., to lobby for Indian rights. He had no way of knowing it at the time, but his affinity for and mastery of the Navajo tongue would one day help save the lives of countless United States Marines. In time, Johnston would leave the American Southwest and the people he loved to serve in World War I. After World War I, he would earn his civil engineering degree at the University of Southern California. December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, found Johnston hard at work as an engineer for the city of Los Angeles. At the time, Johnston was in his 50s and well beyond the grasp of his local draft board. However, his experiences on the battlefields of Europe in an earlier time motivated him to try to put into action a plan that he was sure could help the war effort. Johnston's hope was to help the Marine Corps protect their communications so well that every Marine who wore the uniform would be provided a huge advantage in combat. His idea revolved around a code, but unlike many coding systems, this code was not dependent on a complicated machine or a series of numbers or ciphers. Rather, the heart of his proposal rested on the language of the Navajo Indians. He was convinced that, used properly, the Navajo dialect would provide unprecedented security to those who would need it most. All he needed was a chance to prove it. Johnston's initial efforts to convince the Marines of the worth of his project were less than successful. The Corps had serious doubts. Native Americans, particularly the Choctaw, had been used as code talkers in World War I with positive results. However, it was no secret that after 1918, any number of German nationals had visited the United States with the expressed purpose of learning the languages of American Indian tribes. Most assumed that the Third Reich would share its knowledge of these American Indian languages with its Axis partners. For this reason, many viewed the notion of using these languages to protect military communications as an idea whose time had long passed. But Johnston persisted in his efforts. He believed, with good reason, that the Navajo language was unique. The tribe came from a remote region, and only a handful of non-Navajos had any knowledge of the language. Despite the prevailing wisdom of the time, the Marine Corps finally agreed to host a test of Johnston's proposed system at Camp Elliott near San Diego. At the conclusion of the trial run, everyone agreed that the results had been impressive. The Navajos involved in the demonstration had clearly shown that they could take messages from a variety of sources in English, translate and transmit them in Navajo, and then send them back in English. Due to the success of that trial run, those who had witnessed the testing initially lobbied for the recruitment and training of over 200 code talkers. In the end, a total of only 30 men would be approved for the first group. However, by VJ Day, over 400 Navajos would work in the program. Isn't this fascinating? It continues here. In May of 1942, with the imprimatur of the Navajo Tribal Council, formal recruiting efforts began at Winslow Rock, Arizona, the capital of the Navajo Nation. Philip Johnston, despite his age, expressed a desire to be involved in the recruiting and training of the men. After some thought, the Corps agreed to grant him a waiver and allowed him to enlist in the Marine Corps at the rank of Staff Sergeant. Johnston would only remain in uniform for a short time, but he would always have the satisfaction of knowing he had been the driving force behind a program that would benefit the Corps for years to come. Shortly after the initial recruit training at the San Diego Depot, the group was sent to Camp Pendleton for training in standard radio procedures. After their primary skills had been honed, Johnston and his compatriots began putting into place the system that would protect critical Marine battlefield communications for the duration of the war. At first glance, it would seem that the language itself would be enough to provide the required level of security. However, the Marine Corps realized they could make the system virtually unbreakable by further encoding the language through word substitution. In addition, because the Navajo language contained no words to describe the modern implements of war, the trainees took familiar words from their language and applied them to items such as tanks, which were turtles, and planes, birds. Finally, in order to protect the code from falling into enemy hands, the aforementioned system was committed to memory. This intense training regimen achieved the desired goal of making the code undecipherable to everyone but the code talkers, men like Bill Toledo. And under the heading "From Guadalcanal to Okinawa," this official history continues. The work of the men of the Marine Corps in its conquering of the strategic islands and atolls of the South Pacific is one of the great success stories of modern warfare. Many were responsible for their success, but it cannot be denied that the code talkers played a critical role. Wherever they were employed, whether it was on Saipan or Tarawa, Peleliu or Guam, they performed brilliantly. On Iwo Jima, the Marines fought an entrenched enemy in caves and redoubts from one end of the island to the other. In many cases, the enemy could only be dislodged through fierce hand-to-hand combat followed up by grenades and flamethrowers. When the battle began, 20,000 Japanese troops occupied the island. 36 days later, at battle's end, only 1,083 members of the Imperial Army were left. In this kind of environment, any advantage one could gain over the enemy was welcomed. In this regard, the code talkers and their ability to provide secure communications were a godsend. The record shows that despite the horrific conditions previously described, during the first 48 hours on Iwo Jima, six code talkers working 24-hour shifts sent and received over 800 messages, all without error. Major Howard, the 5th Marine Division signal officer, stated succinctly that, "Were it not for the Navajos, the Marines would have never taken the island." The work of the Navajos on Iwo Jima was impressive, but the larger point is that wherever they did their work, they provided an indispensable advantage to those who wore the globe and anchor. At war's end, Philip Johnston, ever the believer in the code talkers' abilities, sought to make the program permanent, but was ultimately turned down. Instead, like millions of other American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, the Navajo code talkers returned to their homes and their families. Of the 400 or so code talkers who fought on the unforgiving battlefields of the South Pacific, 13 never returned. Those who lived would have the privilege of knowing that they played an indispensable role in protecting critical information from the enemy and in saving countless lives. Even today, when communications circle the globe and the universe at lightning speed, the code talkers' accomplishments serve as an outstanding example of what can happen when cryptologic brilliance is combined with linguistic expertise and dedication to duty. A whole lot of words that pretty much match up with everything Bill Toledo said. The faster they transmit the message and receive it, the more lives they save. Again, that was from the official NSA history on the origins of the Navajo Code Talkers. And now that we have that big picture in view, let's zoom back in on the personal experience of a teenager plucked from the reservation and sent to a war zone. Bill Toledo. I know Bougainville was your first action, but just getting there. I bet you'd never been on a ship before. That had to be quite a journey for you.
That's right, yeah. After we were assigned to 3rd Marine Division, they were ready to move out at Camp Pendleton. I was told, they were told not to ask questions. I met these 3rd Marine Division members there. They were ready to move out. So that's where I joined them. And they were whispering behind me where I was sitting. I was wondering why they were whispering, you know. And I finally caught on to what they were saying. This Indian that has joined us is going to be a Japanese interpreter. That's what they were whispering to each other, you know. So I got to meet them, this bunch there, and spent the night there. And the next day, we were ready to move out. We moved on to San Diego Harbor, where we boarded ship. Great big troop ship called Mount Vernon. Before we boarded the ship, we had lunch. After we set sailing, some of these guys were hanging over the rail, you know, and I just wonder why they were doing that. Here, I guess they were throwing up, you know, I got seasick already, because after that lunch, you know. So that's what happened. Then we were told that we're heading for New Zealand. So when we got down to Equator, they told us to put on our wintergreen uniform and go topside and stand in the sun for 1 hour, because the sun was straight up and it was hot. We were standing there in the sun for 1 hour, and a lot of these guys, they fell over, you know, from the heat. That's how we were initiated, going crossing the equator. And then we went on down to New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. They took us out about 20 miles out into the country where the camp was already set up. That's where we were going to do some training over there. The training mostly was hiking, you know, with a full combat pack, a bedding roll and ration and hand grenade. And we have rifle, ammunition, water. So we hike every day, 20 miles a day. So we were there all through the summer. When 1st Marine Division secures Guadalcanal, they move out, and then we move in, because we were told we would be doing some jungle training there, because the Japanese were really good at jungle warfare. So we wanted to learn something about this warfare in the jungle, you know. So that's where we move in.
So that was on Guadalcanal, still to come. Combat situations and some pretty close calls. The rest of Code Talker Bill Toledo's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When you say the words hearing aid, people think of that big bulky banana behind the ear, when the reality is today's modern hearing aid is completely unnoticeable.
That's Nathan Lev from locally owned Sound Advice with some news worth hearing.
We have access to all the major manufacturers, all the different styles. We carry a product called Lyric, which is a very new type of technology, and it suits a particular individual that is not able to wear a traditional type of hearing device. The Lyric product is the future of hearing devices.
Sound Advice offers its patients the best possible care and new innovative products. Call today to schedule a free hearing test and consultation. 579-1310.
We're not high pressure in any way. We're patient advocates, and we want to find each individual the best possible solution for their scenario.
Call Sound Advice today at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.